It's Here and Now. I'm Jane Clayson in for Robin Young. The number of women dying during pregnancy or childbirth worldwide has plummeted dramatically. That's according to a study out this week in the British medical journal The Lancet. The findings are in sharp contrast to previous reports that show little or no progress in reducing maternal deaths. Researchers looked at data from 181 countries over 3 decades, and some fear the positive results could mean less funding for the cause. Joining us from London is Dr. Richard Horton, the editor of The Lancet. Dr. Horton, thanks for being with us.
Hello.
Your study shows a 35% drop in maternal deaths over a 28-year period. Were you surprised by these findings?
I was stunned by these findings. For the last 20 years, we've genuinely believed that we've been spending good money after bad, and it's had no effect on maternal health whatsoever. And what these findings show is that we've been utterly wrong for a generation. In fact, that investment has made a huge difference for women's health.
The raw numbers show that there were over 500,000 maternal deaths worldwide in 1980, and that's down now to 340,000 maternal deaths in 2008. To what do you attribute the improvements? Are there some more notable revelations from specific areas here?
The main reasons why we've seen this dramatic success is because women are choosing to have smaller families, incomes are going up, even in some of the poorest countries of the world. Girls are getting better education, and we know that with better education, family size gets smaller. And there are also more midwives available who can guide women through a safer pregnancy and childbirth. So in parts of the world like Latin America and the Asia-Pacific region, we've seen quite substantial declines in maternal mortality, but, and this is a big but, the area where we are seeing no progress at all, in fact it's getting worse in many countries, is sub-Saharan Africa. We're not going to solve the problem of maternal health in Africa unless we also do more to solve the problem of HIV. That's going to require a very different approach to the approach we've had in the past, where we've treated these two issues as entirely separate. They're not. They're dependent on one another.
Well, for a long time, the prevailing figure of maternal death was about 500,000 annual maternal deaths worldwide. In fact, your journal published a study not too long ago showing about 536,000 maternal deaths just in 2005. So how do you account, Doctor, for such a wide discrepancy over the course of just 3 years?
It is a big difference, and the reason for the difference is that what this study has done is to gather 3 times the number of accurate measurements from countries around the world. And getting that more accurate, more reliable data firsthand from those countries has enabled these researchers to get very precise estimates, and it's those precise estimates which have shown that actually we've been making this dramatic progress.
Let me mention yet another study by World Health Organization Group, which shows essentially no improvement in the state of maternal health. In fact, claiming that 500,000 women are still dying in childbirth every year. And in that report, the United Nations claims that it needs $20 billion every year up until 2015 to save these women and children in developing countries. Can you explain that?
I think what we're seeing here is a very unfortunate clash between science and advocacy. And the United Nations is in an impossible position. On the one hand, it's the guardian of numbers, and you report the number that they have described. But on the other hand, they're also the world's advocate for health. And here they have this conflict of interest. To them, it's probably best to use the highest possible number to take to politicians and say, look, this is such a bad problem, we need this huge amount of money to make a difference for it. But I think they've got their arguments upside down, because if you spent 20 years going to political leaders saying, please give us more money, and yet you've been showing no progress whatsoever, why on earth would those politicians give you more money to throw after the money you've wasted in the past? What these numbers, what this reduction by a third shows, is that actually that investment has made a massive difference. Mm. And now we have a completely compelling argument to go to politicians and say, yes, you have to give us more investment for women's health because we now can prove that it's making a difference.
You mentioned the clash between science and advocacy. It's been reported that some of these women's rights activists tried to pressure your group, The Lancet, into delaying these findings. Is that true?
We were asked by several individuals if we would delay publication until later in the year after some very big advocacy events were due to take place. They were anxious that a lower figure for maternal mortality would jeopardize their chances of securing more investment for women's health. But I think that argument, while it's understandable and defensible in some ways, actually has the potential to do the cause of women's health huge damage. Look at what happened in climate change. Look at what happened when it appeared as if the science was being manipulated for political ends. We saw a dramatic fall in public and political confidence in the science for climate change. We cannot repeat those mistakes for maternal health, because women are literally dying every day around the world when they needn't.
Dr. Richard Horton is the editor of the medical journal The Lancet, speaking to us today from London. Dr. Horton, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gun rights advocates are issuing a warning to people who want to attend the Second Amendment walk through downtown Urbana, Illinois this weekend. Long guns will be inspected and handguns will be holstered. But gun control advocates say not so fast. They point out that Illinois has some of the strictest gun laws in the nation, and an owner there cannot carry a gun either concealed or in the open in public. And they're pushing back against what they see as a growing movement among gun activists who want to openly carry their guns in places such as Starbucks, which allows it where it's legal. And that's in most states, where anyone can openly carry a handgun without a permit or any sort of special training or testing. The issue has prompted a state lawmaker in California to propose a bill to outlaw open carry in her state. Earlier this week, the issue was given the Daily Show treatment on Comedy Central, and open carry advocates were willingly compared to gay rights advocates.
I open carry every day of my life. I open carry when I head to the bank. I open carry when I grab a cup of coffee at Starbucks.
Do they look at you funny?
Yes, because we want gun ownership and gun carry to come out of the closet.
That's John Pierce, co-founder of the advocacy group OpenCarry.org. He joins me now from St. Paul, Minnesota. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Help us understand open carry. Do you carry your handgun out in the open every day?
I do. I should caveat that by saying that, obviously, as I travel around the country, there are states where open carry is, in fact, not legal, and there are places in the various states where open carry, and in some cases concealed carry, is off limits. And first and foremost, we're law-abiding. So if there are places where one cannot open or conceal carry, then obviously I leave the firearm behind.
So when you do open carry, is your gun loaded or unloaded?
Loaded. The only state where we really have the issue of unloaded open carry is California.
Do people often tell you they feel uncomfortable when they see you with your gun?
No, that almost never happens. In the vast majority of the cases where people actually approach me and say, wow, I didn't know that was legal, can you tell me a little bit more about that? People are never made uncomfortable or frightened.
And yet you know that there are many jurisdictions where police say people call in a panic when they see someone like you carrying a gun into a restaurant or a cafe or anywhere else.
Well, in places like California where open carry is new, you tend to get a little bit of reaction from people who are unfamiliar with it. And out of an abundance of caution, they're checking in with law enforcement. And that's exactly what we as a civilized society want people to do, is we keep our law enforcement informed of what's going on in our communities. And that's one of our goals at OpenCarry.org, is to make sure that law enforcement as well as citizens are educated about what the current legal status of open carry is in their jurisdictions.
So beyond the education, what is the reason you want to carry a gun in the open? Do you feel safer? Are you trying to make a statement?
I personally carry for two reasons. The first reason is simply this. The right that is enumerated by the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is the right to openly carry. And then the second is as a normalization technique. And as long as people do not see their friends, their neighbors, their relatives, their loved ones openly carrying, making a very clear statement that they, in fact, are gun owners and are people who exercise their right to bear arms, then they're able to buy into the myth that, in fact, it's a rare occurrence. In point of fact, it's not. We have more than half the households in this country have guns in them. There are over 6 million permit holders across the country now.
Let me ask you about the 2008 Supreme Court case, because the High Court ruled in the case of the District of Columbia versus Heller that the Second Amendment guarantees a citizen the right to have a gun at home for self-defense. But gun control advocates say the High Court has never held that the Second Amendment protects the carrying of guns outside the home, that in fact it is not a right. What's your response to that?
Well, ultimately, when we're defining rights, we refer to Supreme Court cases. You know, we're looking to stare decisis. And they are correct in that the holding in Heller addressed a particular question that was presented by the plaintiff in that case. And they didn't address the boundaries of the carry argument other than in some dicta in the case, and I suspect we'll see that as we go forward in various and sundry lawsuits.
So, John, yes. If open carry is already legal in most states, why do you want to expand gun rights? Is it your intention then to sort of normalize gun carrying? Is that the bottom line?
Absolutely. And also, though, you bring up a very good point. Really, there are still American citizens, though, living in states where they do not have these rights. And we want to protect the rights that are in existence and enhance them where they need to be enhanced.
What about concealed carry laws? Most states allow gun owners to carry a concealed weapon with a permit. But I understand you object to how the permits are actually given out. How so?
Well, what we have are two states where concealed carry permits are, in fact, not available. That would be Wisconsin and Illinois. And then you have 10 states where they do what is known as may issue or discretionary issue, allows the licensing authority to take a law-abiding citizen who has completed the training requirement, who has passed the background check, and deny them for arbitrary reasons. And that certainly sounds very 1950s Selma, Alabama to me.
Where does the National Rifle Association stand on the open carry issue? Do they stand with you? Because an NRA leader told the New York Times last month that they're trying to distance themselves from the open carry advocates. Is there a rift among gun advocates? Are you working together on this?
Well, I would say that we're not working together on it, but I would also say there's not a rift. Both groups have entirely different focuses. The NRA has focused very successfully, I might add, on moving forward the concealed carry public policy agenda that has literally swept the nation in the last couple of decades. And we're not trying to regenerate the need. We fully support the concealed carry movement, but what we're trying to do is make sure people don't forget about the fact that the right that underlays the privilege of concealed carry is open carry.
John Pierce, thank you very much for your time today, sir.
Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
We're talking about gun rights. Most states allow the open carry of handguns without a permit. Joining me now from Indiana is Paul Helmke, president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. He's a Republican and a former mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, and he joins us from there now. Hello, Paul.
Thank you.
You recently told The Daily Show on Comedy Central that anyone who carries a gun all the time is, quote, not a normal human being and should stay indoors, end quote. How do you view the open carry movement?
I think it's dangerous. It's something I hear John talk all about rights, and he's not even concerned about personal protection. He's just concerned about making a statement. He doesn't talk at all about the risks that go with gun ownership and display of guns and carrying guns. He doesn't talk about the responsibilities that go with it. And there are real risks, and there are real responsibilities. And you know, when you see more people carrying more guns in more places, we're just asking for more trouble. Accidents happen. People misuse their guns. The guns are dropped. The guns are stolen. The guns are taken. The guns are left where they shouldn't be. And that endangers all of us. In a civilized society, I don't picture people taking guns every place. That was the kind of society that the open carry group wants. They want nearly anyone to be able to take nearly any kind of gun anywhere at any time.
So what's your response to John Pierce when he says this is his Second Amendment right?
Well, the Second Amendment, actually, John talked about stare decisis, which is interesting, because until 2008, the Supreme Court had never found an individual right to keep and bear arms. It had always dealt with the first part of the Second Amendment that talks about the well-regulated militia. And, in fact, the last time the Supreme Court had talked about this until the Heller case was in 1939 when they said that, you know, it dealt with a well-regulated militia. But then they decided not to follow past precedent, and they changed their opinion, and they, for the first time, said there's an individual right to keep and bear arms, and specifically to have a right to have a gun in your home for self-defense. But as you said, they made it clear that this right is not unlimited. Justice Scalia said you can have limitations on who gets guns, where they take guns, how guns are sold, how guns are stored, how guns are carried, and what kind of guns there are. And those are the sorts of limitations, common sense restrictions that we think are important. I'm not anti-gun, but guns are a serious danger, a serious risk, and there are serious responsibilities that go with them. And I think that society has a right to say we don't want all these guns every place all the time.
Your group has put together an online petition urging Starbucks to restrict the open carry of guns in its shops, just as Pete's Coffee and the California Pizza Kitchen have also done. Why is that an important effort for you?
It's in California a few months back, some of the open carry folks, in order to make their political statements, started carrying guns into all sorts of restaurants. And when people saw that, they started contacting us. They said, this bothers us. We don't want to take our families where folks are hauling guns around. And is this legal? And we said, yes, sadly, it's legal in most places. And they said, is there anything we can do about it? And we said, yes, private property rights still exist in this country, and private business owners still have a right to keep guns out of their stores, just the same as they can say, you know, no shoes, no shirt, no service, or, you know, loud and boisterous behavior is not allowed, and they can keep guns out. And so people would ask Pete's Coffee or California Pizza Kitchen, and they said, that makes sense to us. We're going to keep guns out of our stores. Starbucks kind of passed the buck on this thing. They said, gee, well, we do what the law requires. Well, the law doesn't require them to allow guns in their stores. If a state allows open carry on the streets, that doesn't force Starbucks to allow those guns to be openly carried into Starbucks. So we asked people to sign a petition asking Starbucks to change its policy. Over 35,000 people signed that petition. There were people at the Starbucks annual shareholders meeting a few weeks back that even asked the CEO about it, and he must not have understood what their policy was or what the law was, because he said, well, no, these aren't people that are loaded. These aren't loaded guns in our stores. But yes, it is. Not in California, but in Washington, where Starbucks is located, and most other states, actually, they are loaded guns that are being taken into their stores. They don't have to allow that, and we think that's better for personal protection, public safety, and the safety of our families.
Beyond the response to your petition, I'm curious, how would you characterize where we are right now in the fight over gun ownership in this country?
It's the folks that like and love their guns are trying to push guns in every nook and corner in our society. They've been very successful because most of our elected officials are scared to death to say no to these folks. And it's scary. And I think most people think there are some laws on the books that really restrict things, but there really are very few laws on the books. You know, John talks about people being tested and trained and all that for concealed carry. For open carry, they don't have to have any testing or training. I was talking to the police chief here in Fort Wayne just the other day, and for concealed carry permits, there's no training or testing required. I ran a police department for 12 years, or oversaw a police department as mayor for 12 years. Even trained police officers make mistakes with their guns. It happens everywhere all the time, and these are professionals who have had training, testing on when to shoot, when not to shoot, psychological testing. They make mistakes. If they make mistakes, what do we expect any Tom, Dick, and Harry out there who just decides, gee, I want to play wide ERP and carry my gun around? What's going to happen with that situation? It's going to put the rest of it at risk, and it really is irresponsible.
Paul Helmke, thank you for your time and your perspective, sir.
Thank you.
A paper released today from the United Nations University says that far more people in India have access to cell phones than to a toilet. And worldwide, over 1 billion people are forced to defecate in the open for lack of any other option. The report's authors say the economic cost is billions of dollars lost due to illness. But there's a human cost, too. 2.5 million people die each year. And in the last 3 years, 4.5 million children have died because of inadequate sanitation. That's about the population of Ireland. Dr. Zafar Adil is one of the authors of this study. He's director of the university's think tank, the Institute for Water, Environment, and Health. And he joins us today from Paris. Dr. Adil, you say that people who want to provide toilets to the poor should look at the cell phone industry. Why?
The comparison with the cell phone industry is an interesting one because they have found a marketing model or a business model in which they're able to sell really cheap services to consumers so that people who cannot even afford a toilet can, in fact, afford a cell phone. What that says to us is that you have to retool the business model that is used for supply and provisioning of toilets and other sanitation services.
So how do you do that? How do you replicate that business model that works so effectively for cell phones? How do you replicate that for basic sanitation?
Well, part of that has to deal with governments providing the enabling environment, and that means the right type of rules and regulations that facilitate local entrepreneurs to invest into this business. On the other side, it also probably requires a capital investment from the national governments, sometimes from the international development community, to build some of the basic infrastructure needed, on top of which the private entrepreneurs can deploy the services and essentially enable the local economy to provide the solutions which are needed.
So basically this comes down to entrepreneurs at the very base level. I mean, you talk about clean water and toilets requiring a lot more complicated procedures, you know, as far as public works projects to store and capture and treat the water and public education about their benefits. I mean, that seems much harder than selling a cell phone.
Well, actually, there are some really innovative solutions which are available, models of toilets which don't require running water. In some cases, they also produce biogas, which is an energy source, and people can actually do really profitable business. The estimates that we have is that every dollar invested can lead to a net gain of $8 to $9, and that includes cost savings to the public health infrastructure. It means increased productivity. It also means lesser number of days of missed school for children, particularly for girls.
Why girls?
Well, girls are particularly impacted by lack of sanitation, particularly as they reach puberty. They are not able to attend schools which don't have toilet facilities because of their specific needs and the need for privacy. And if the school doesn't have those facilities, we see this quite a lot in developing countries. They simply stop going to school when they hit the age of puberty.
You mentioned the toilets and the different business models that would exist for entrepreneurs. Are there specific examples of those kinds of businesses?
Well, yes, there are a number of examples. I'll just cite two. In Bangladesh, there's a number of successful examples, particularly in the rural settings, where the communities themselves have set up the infrastructure. They've worked through the local entrepreneurs to provide service to their own communities. There's also an example in Kenya, particularly in urban slums, where the local NGOs have gone in and set up public toilets, which are essentially pay-per-use toilets. Now, they don't quite meet the standard of what we would call improved sanitation, but it's a very significant improvement over the prior situation. In the second example, the local community operators can actually make a profit. So there are a number of good examples around the world where these type of innovative models have worked.
Dr. Zafar Adil, thank you very much for your time today, sir.
Well, it's a pleasure speaking to you, Jen.
Just ahead, a new book tells the story of an accident in the high seas and the dramatic rescue that followed. Back after a short break. It's Here and Now. In May 2005, the 45-foot sailboat Almaisen set off from Connecticut for a 5-day cruise to Bermuda. On board were Captain Tom Tighe, First Mate Locke Reedy, and three crew members, Ron Bird, Chris Ferrer, and Kathy Gilchrist, who paid for the adventure and to gain more sailing experience. But before Bermuda, on the fourth day of the cruise, a Saturday night, in the middle of the ocean, a huge storm hit the Almaisen. The boat rolled and was severely damaged. Two of the five shipmates were swept overboard. Three remained on a boat that was rapidly taking on water. Michael Togas writes about the Almaisen disaster and the daring rescues that followed in the new book, Overboard, A True Blue Water Odyssey of Disaster. And he joins me in the studio. Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is one of the survivors of that disaster, Chris Ferrer. Chris, nice to have you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Michael, the storm occurred in the Gulf Stream between Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, and Bermuda. And both Captain Tom Tighe and Locke Reedy, the crew of the Almaisen, were experienced seamen. They'd sailed these seas many times before. I think Captain Tighe sailed it 48 times. What makes this area so dangerous?
Well, you've got the Gulf Stream coming up from the southeast, and at times, if you have a low-pressure system and the wind is spinning out of the north, it can really stack up the waves. So in one respect, it was a good thing they were in the Gulf Stream because the water temperature is so warm. But on the other hand, that's where the waves get the worst during a storm.
Chris, talk about what the voyage was like before the storm.
Actually, when we left Connecticut, it was dead calm, and it was dead calm for a day and a half. We were motoring the entire way.
You couldn't even get a sail up.
No, not at all.
And then what happened?
And then the wind started to pick up, and the seas got larger. I'm not prone to seasickness. This is the first time I got seasick, but I got very, very seasick. And I was incapacitated for a day and a half or so. And Saturday night, I felt well enough to go get some rest down below, because up until that point, I did not leave the cockpit of the boat. I stayed above deck because I tried going below once, and it just made it 10 times worse.
So, Michael, then describe what happened to the boat when the storm hit.
Well, there was one wave, and it's debatable whether you call it a rogue wave or just one wave bigger than all the others. But this wave actually capsized the boat, and up in the cockpit were Tom, Locke, and Kathy. And Kathy was swept out of the boat, and the only thing that saved her was the safety harness and the tether that she had on. Down below, the boat took on hundreds and hundreds of gallons of water.
Chris, you were asleep when you woke up and found yourself underwater.
Correct. Underwater and totally disoriented. I wake up underwater under a blanket, and I just remember from growing up in swimming lessons, like when you're unaware of where you are underwater, blow some bubbles and follow the bubbles up. And sure enough, I did that, and at the same time, the boat was righting itself. So I got above the water, looked around, and I saw I was utter destruction down below. And then I heard Captain Tighe calling from on deck for Ron and myself to come on deck.
They were able to get Kathy on board the boat, thank God. And then the captain determined that with so much water in the boat, if another big wave hits, it's not going to come back up again. So he determines it's time to prepare the life raft, which they do. But these winds are just so strong, it just takes the life raft away like a kite. And they get it to within maybe 5 or 6 feet of the boat, and they can't get it any closer to board it. So Locke makes really a fateful decision that I'm going to jump in it. So he dives in, and the next rogue wave hits the vessel.
When we got hit by the rogue wave, the boat got knocked down, and I get up, and I realize I look overboard, and I see the life raft turned upside down. I remember shimmering there. There were lights on deck, so you could see maybe within a 30-foot radius of the boat, and I see the life raft upside down, and then I look, and I see Tom Tighe in the water, and I'm looking around, and I realize Tom and Locke are not on the boat anymore. Keep in mind, the winds are blowing about 40 knots, and the boat is drifting a knot and a half or 2 knots. And so we're moving away pretty rapidly from Locke and Tom. And then I hear, Chris, help me. And I look behind me, and I see Ron dragging through the water, attached to the boat with his tether. Hmm. I'm able to pull him on board. And then we all look at each other and realize that we're alone on this boat.
When you say a rogue wave, what is that? Can you describe what a rogue wave looks like?
Typically, it's one twice the size of the usual waves that have been coming in. They can occur during calm conditions or during a storm. I've been researching them. My personal theory is two waves joined together. into one super wave.
The waves were enormous that day. At one point, you're sitting on top of the wave, and you look all around you, and you just see these giant wave trains of house-sized waves. The waves were 30 and 40 feet tall. And then the next thing you know, you're down in the trough, and you just see a wall of gray water around you. I tell you, though, at certain times, when the sun was really low in the sky, the sun would shine through the waves, and it was the most beautiful thing you've ever seen, this gorgeous blue, translucent. It was quite beautiful.
Beautiful, yes. And very dangerous.
and quite large, yes. So it certainly wasn't terrifying all the time. You get used to it.
Michael, in the book, you include the stories of the rescuers. Mm-hmm. Those in the boat, in the helicopter, the rescue swimmers, they were all looking for the Amundsen. But they were also in the storm, and they were encountering dangerous conditions as well, weren't they?
This rescue was so dangerous and complicated, it was selected by the Coast Guard as the search and rescue case of the year from among thousands.
Chris, they eventually did rescue you and Kathy and Ron off the boat. Do you remember that moment?
I remember the entire episode vividly. Ron was on the radio speaking to the Coast Guard pilot on the helicopter, and he gave Ron directions on how we should get off the boat, and it was decided that we have to jump in the water one at a time, and the rescue swimmer will swim over to us, put us in the harness, and pull us up. Actually, they tried to pull Kathy up in the basket, but the wire jammed in the door, and it took them quite a while to unjam it. And I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at Ron, thinking, like, this is taking an awful long time. And then finally, they do get it free. A helicopter comes back, and I tell you, I had no problem diving into the water, like, head first.
And Captain Ty and First Mate Reedy are still out there. And somewhere. You don't know if they're alive or dead.
Exactly, because at one point we heard that one of the vessels that came to assist us, the Socorro Express, they actually found the life raft and they said it was empty. And we heard that over the VHF radio. So that was probably the lowest point.
These rogue waves that the Amundsen encountered, how common are they? And was this a sort of once-in-a-lifetime kind of accident?
They're common in a storm when you're in the Gulf Stream. That much is known. And Captain Ty thought he would be well to the east of this storm, but this thing just blew up. You know, it was twice the size forecasted.
Michael Togas is the author of Overboard, a true blue water odyssey of disaster and survival. Michael, thank you very much.
And thank you.
Chris Freer, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
So what about Locke Reedy and Tom Ty? When we come back, we'll talk to Reedy about his amazing story. You're listening to Here and Now. We've been revisiting the May 2005 capsizing of the sailing boat Almason, as told in the new book Overboard. As we heard before the break, en route to Bermuda in the middle of a storm, the Almason was hit by a huge wave which capsized the boat and severely damaged it. While the five crew members were attempting to board the life raft, another wave swept Captain Tom Ty and First Mate Locke Reedy into the ocean. Though three members of the Almason crew were rescued, they had no idea if Tom and Locke were still alive or what had happened to them. To answer that now, we welcome Locke Reedy to the program. He joins us from the studios of Yale University. Locke, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's begin with the moment that you were separated from the boat.
I dove off the boat into the life raft with a plan that one of the crew members, Ron Bird, would throw me a heavier line so we could secure it to the boat. And then we would get into it and deboard the Almason. I was still in the life raft when the next wave came over the boat. And next thing I knew, it was dead quiet, and I knew I was underwater again. And when I surfaced, I saw the life raft blowing away. It was upside down. And then I heard Tom's voice also in the water, and we found each other. It was dark. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning when that happened. The real difficulty was the fact that the waves were breaking on top of us. Fortunately, we had our harnesses still on, and we were able to hook ourselves together so we wouldn't get separated by the churning of the ocean. It was just debilitating watching the sailboat move away behind the waves and just disappearing. And there was nothing the folks on the sailboat could do to find us because they had no idea where we were, and the boat was not maneuvering well at all because it had so much water in it.
How long were you out there?
We went over approximately 4 o'clock in the morning. Tom and I were located, I think, around 3:30 or 4 o'clock the next morning by a tanker that was brought into the search by the Coast Guard.
So you're out in the middle of the ocean, and you're holding on literally for dear life. And at some point, you begin to realize that Captain Tom Tighe was slipping away.
Yes. When it got light, we were able to converse fairly well at the beginning. And then I noticed Tom was having a harder time talking. I could see he was having a difficult time fighting the waves. And Tom was ingesting a lot of water. He started to gasp. He was leaning over on his side, reaching under his life vest to basically rub his chest. And I was fairly certain that he was probably having some heart distress. As his breathing became more and more labored, he was not able to converse any longer. And I tried to give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. He was clearly failing. And he died, my guess is he drowned about 11 in the morning.
And this is in front of you, you're watching this.
He was in my arms.
And when he died, you made him a promise, didn't you?
I did. Prior to his passing, he was trying to give me his life vest. He was trying to take it off. He couldn't speak at that point, but he was clearly motioning for me to take his life vest. And I said, no, Tom, I need you to stay with me. I will get you home. And that was the promise I made to Tom. Excuse me. And it drove me to go as far as I could to basically keep that promise.
Can you describe what it was like, Locke, to be in the ocean alone after that?
It just the enormity of the situation was such that looking around the ocean, the waves were still 30, 40 feet, and the wind was blowing, it would rain. It was just horrible conditions. We had seen earlier in the day Coast Guard planes. I knew they knew we were out here. It was just a matter of being well enough to help affect the search. So I deliberately forced the negative thoughts out of the hopelessness, if you will, away from my thought process. It was difficult to do. The ocean was relentless. It just kept breaking on us and breaking on us. But the alternative was to give up, and I couldn't do that. I had to fulfill my promise to Tom.
The Sakura Express did come to rescue you, but even that wasn't easy.
They just couldn't see me. But I could see them. The ship was huge. It was well over 600 feet, and all its lights were on. So I knew they knew I was around. We rolled under a huge wave, and when I surfaced, I couldn't find the ship. And looked, I spun around, and there it was. But all of the lights, the deck lights, it was lit up like a city, had been extinguished. And I said, they've given up. You know, I just had it on my mind that they were leaving. So I got Tom's body ahead of me and just started swimming, kicking as fast as I could towards the ship, and yelling as loud as I could. And as I swam and yelled, the lights came back on, and all hell broke loose on the deck, and apparently they saw me. And I swam up to the side of the ship, and they eventually lowered a cargo net into the ocean, and I thought I had put Tom into the cargo net, and I was hanging on the outside of the cargo net as they were lifting it, and I had entangled my legs in it so I wouldn't fall out. They hoisted the cargo net up, and awful sight. I saw Tom floating in the water, and I did not have him in the net. I tried to get out to get back to him, but by the time I got my legs free, I was on the deck, and they eventually did recover Tom, but I almost lost him.
Locke, it's been almost 5 years since this happened, and I'm curious, I can hear it in your voice, but I wish you'd tell me how this accident has impacted your life.
I think about the Coast Guard every day. I think about the incident every day in one respect or another, not in a negative manner at all, but rather I'm just proud that I could see what they could accomplish and what they did and how many people were involved just to find us. And what really dedicated people there are and good people there are out in the world who will basically risk their lives for other people. It kind of makes it all worthwhile if you really think about it.
We've been told that your former crew member, Chris, still sails. Do you?
I don't have the opportunity to sail that much. I would. I'd go back out in a minute. If somebody asked me to go with them on a cruise to Bermuda or across the Atlantic, I'd go in a second.
You would? You'd do it again?
I'd say yes, absolutely. I'd go in a second. I love the ocean. I truly do. To be out there at night, to look up and see the Milky Way and all the stars and just know that it's just a great, great, great place. It tried to kill me, but it didn't.
Locke Reedy, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Locke Reedy is former first mate of the ship Al Misson. His story is told in Michael Togas' new book, Overboard, A True Blue Water Odyssey of Disaster and Survival.